Welcome to OncLive On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. OncLive On Air is a podcast from OncLive, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, OncLive covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. OncLive is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. We recently traveled to Little Rock, Arkansas for a State of the Science Summit on lung cancer. In advance of the meeting, we launched a Twitter poll inquiring whether it would be best to use single-agent immunotherapy versus combination chemotherapy and immunotherapy in a certain patient with non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer. During the meeting, we asked attendees to answer the poll to gauge their thoughts on these treatment interventions and see if our Twitter audience and our live audience were in agreement on which approach would be most effective. In keeping with the changing landscape of lung cancer, we decided to bring on two experts from the meeting to further discuss the results of the poll and shed light on the data that support each intended treatment choice. First, we spoke with Stephen V. Liu, MD, an associate professor of medicine at MedStar Georgetown University Medical Center, who shared a case of a male patient with non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer who presents in the clinic with a 4-centimeter right upper lobe mass, regional adenopathy, and bony metastases. Listen on to hear the complete case presentation.
Dr. Anatakis, our first case involves a 59-year-old male with non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer who presents with a 4-centimeter right lobe mass, regional adenopathy, and bony metastases. He does have mild pain at the site of several metastases, but he can tolerate it and is working full time. He undergoes rapid molecular testing, which identifies a KRAS G12D mutation. He's also found to have high PD-L1 expression at 80% using the DACO22C3 antibody. And so we asked our audience what they recommended as initial therapy. Among the listed options were pembrolizumab monotherapy, pembrolizumab in combination with carboplatin and pemetrexed, atezolizumab with bevacizumab, carboplatin, and paclitaxel, and atezolizumab monotherapy. And these were options listed on a poll to our audience, as well as through Twitter. We got several responses. 50% of the audience had voted for pembrolizumab. 42% had voted for pembrolizumab with carboplatin pemetrexed. 8% voted atezolizumab with carboplatin, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab, and no votes for atezolizumab monotherapy. And our in-house audience was very similar in distribution to the Twitter audience. When we look at these four options, I think there is a wrong answer. Atezolizumab as first-line monotherapy is not currently an FDA-approved regimen. There's no data to support its use in that setting, and this would not be an appropriate answer. But really, of the other three, all of them would be reasonable answers. I think all defensible, all appropriate on a standardized exam. Pembrolizumab, certainly supported by the KEYNOTE-24 study, looking at pembrolizumab monotherapy versus chemotherapy, showing a survival benefit. KEYNOTE-189 looked at pembrolizumab with chemotherapy, specifically carboplatin pemetrexed in non-squamous lung cancer, also showing a survival benefit over chemotherapy. And the EMPOWER 150 regimen of carboplatin, paclitaxel, bevacizumab, and atezolizumab, the four-drug regimen, showing superiority over carboplatin, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab, again, with a survival benefit. So all three of those, I think, would be reasonable answers, all with their own rationale. I think my answer in this situation, gentlemen with 80% PD-L1 expression, mild symptoms, I would preferentially give them the combination of pembrolizumab with carboplatin pemetrexed. This is a regimen that I feel has been well tolerated, has a very impressive survival benefit, and I do believe there's potential synergy between the chemotherapy and pembro. While pembrolizumab on its own, certainly an approved option, I feel that the combination offers better short-term benefit in terms of the three-month PFS rate and the potential for some patients for longer benefit as well. So I think my clinical practice today would be to offer this gentleman pembrolizumab with carboplatin pemetrexed. Now, I wonder what your offer to this patient would be. How would you manage this patient in your practice, Dr. Anatakis?
Well, Dr. Liu, thank you for the introduction. I think this is something that many people struggle nowadays because both regimens are FDA approved for high PD-L1 expression. And there are definitely pros and cons for each option. As you mentioned, the KEYNOTE-024 showed survival benefit of pembrolizumab compared to chemotherapy. and the combination chemotherapy and immunotherapy in the IMpower 150 and Keynote 189 similarly. In my practice, I use both regimens, but I prefer monotherapy, especially in patients who are relatively asymptomatic and they have not significant bulk disease. Unfortunately, that's not very easily, there's no easy way to define bulk of disease. I think it's more of a clinical judgment. So for patients who have relatively low bulk disease, I prefer monotherapy. And for patients who we want significant response rate quickly, I would prefer the chemotherapy in combination with immunotherapy. The interesting thing in this poll is the low percentage of preference in the poll for atezolizumab with the four regimen. I don't know what your take is on this.
Yeah, I agree that 8% for the IMpower 150 regimen was certainly the lowest option chosen. And I think there's a couple of reasons for it. Certainly, this is the most recent approval, so maybe less familiarity with the four-drug regimen. But I also think that the hesitance is not necessarily the atezolizumab versus the pembrolizumab, but really the chemotherapy backbone. And when we're talking about chemo combinations, the pembro combination with carboplatin pemetrexed, probably the most widely utilized chemotherapy backbone for adenocarcinoma in the U.S., very well tolerated, no alopecia, very effective drug. Whereas for the IMpower 150, the chemotherapy regimen is carboplatin paclitaxel, more neuropathy, potential for infusion reactions, alopecia overall, just less well tolerated. And so I think that it has less to do with the immunotherapy partner, which may or may not be relevant, and I think has much more to do with the chemotherapy that's chosen. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I think so. It's in the recent years also the uptake for patients who have received carboplatin paclitaxel bevacizumab, although this was an approved regimen in the era before immunotherapy, was not extremely popular compared to the more user-friendly regimens such as carboplatin pemetrexed.
I agree. I think that the choice of monotherapy versus combination therapy, looking at the pembrolizumab alone versus pembro plus carbopemetrexed, is a very difficult debate if we're left with really just comparing cross-trial. You know, both offered a survival benefit over chemotherapy. And I think we agree that chemotherapy alone is really substandard care in this setting. But choosing between pembro and the pembro combo, you know, while both show an OS benefit, if you look at the group that were PD-L1 high within Keynote 189, PFS hazard ratio was very striking, 0.36, compared to 0.50 in the monotherapy study. The survival hazard ratio, 0.42, compared to 0.63 in the pembro mono. Again, this is cross-trial, not statistically valid, but certainly some very impressive numbers in the PD-L1 high group. And you know, in this population, what we also notice when we look at the Kaplan-Meier curves for progression-free survival, there's a bit of a drop-off in the first couple of months with pembro mono. There are some patients who have that initial progression, whereas with pembro plus chemotherapy, we don't have that initial drop-off. The PFS curves split very quickly, and you're able to, I think, get more patients through those first few months by adding chemotherapy. But I think we agree that the true test to compare both of these will be long-term survival. And really, the whole point of the immunotherapy approach is to get more 3, 4, 5 year survivors. And until that much time has passed, it's going to be difficult to compare these two.
Right. Another thing, and I don't know your take on this, is the fact that the way the triple regimen was approved was for regardless of PD-L1 expression, although recently NCCN require at least 1%, and many clinicians found that it's extremely helpful in terms of approval, starting with the combination chemo-immunotherapy, and then later, if the PD-L1 expression was high, they had to decide based on the tolerance for chemotherapy if they will continue with a triple regimen or with a monotherapy, while for the monotherapy, you had the requirement for a PD-L1 expression of at least 1%. So some clinicians sometimes felt that this was very convenient to start the patients on treatment without having to wait for the report of the PD-L1 expression.
Right. So you don't need the PD-L1 expression to begin combination therapy. You can start quicker, and certainly that could be an advantage. And while pembrolizumab we know is approved for the 1%, we've been a bit skeptical about its appropriateness for patients between 1 to 49, but ongoing studies will hopefully clarify that a bit more.
In the initial presentation, the patient had a KRAS G12D mutation. However, targeted therapy was not mentioned as a potential choice. Where does immunotherapy stand in relation to targeted therapy, especially for some of these more common driver mutations?
Now, this patient was found to have a KRAS G12D mutation. There's been some advances in the world of targeting KRAS, though not for KRAS G12D. That was really for KRAS G12C. And I don't think that KRAS really influences our choices right now in the absence of STK11 or KEAP3 alterations. But if we were to change this case a bit, and this patient were an EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer who had already exhausted TKI therapy, would you offer any of these regimens to that patient?
So for, that's a good question. So there's data with IMpower 150, which included some patients with EGFR mutation, that there was in a subgroup analysis, some survival benefit with the combination of atezolizumab with paclitaxel, carboplatin, and bevacizumab. So for those patients who have progressed on EGFR mutation, I will probably go with the option of atezolizumab with bevacizumab, carboplatin, paclitaxel.
Yeah, I agree. I will also admit that the data is not as strong as we'd like. In the subset of patients in the IMpower 150 who had EGFR and ALK alterations, which was an exploratory subset, the hazard ratio for survival was 0.54, even better than the overall OS hazard ratio, 0.78. And if we take out the ALK subgroup and just look at patients with EGFR alterations, we saw that the overall survival hazard ratio was 0.31. That for patients with sensitizing EGFR mutations in an updated ESMO Asia. So hazard ratio of 0.31 is quite striking. The number of patients was small and was 58 overall. And this is not a predefined population, quite a bit of heterogeneity, whether they'd received TKIs or not. So it's far from a perfect subset, but in that subset, there was a pretty striking OS benefit. So while the use of this regimen of carbo, pac, bev, atezo in EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer is not part of the FDA label, it is approved in other parts of the world. There is some data to support it. And I think that if we're going to deliver immunotherapy to someone with an EGFR alteration, I think this regimen probably has the strongest evidence out of what's available. And so for my EGFR patients, after they've exhausted EGFR TKIs, I do agree. I think that the carbopac bevatezo regimen is an appealing one.
Yes, and unfortunately, there are not many trials that have included EGFR positive patients, and the numbers are quite small to make definitive conclusions in those trials too. So this is pretty much the only thing we have for the moment.
You're absolutely right. I think that we want to stress that this is not to be used before TKIs. We saw a phase 2 study from Aaron Lisberg and Eddie Yaron looking at pembro monotherapy in EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer with PD-L1 expression. And those patients, even with high PD-L1 expression, did not respond to pembrolizumab. The response rate was 0%. In addition, use of immunotherapy prior to TKIs, such as osimertinib, unfortunately does increase the toxicity profile, something we're still struggling to understand. And so our initial treatment for an EGFR mutant lung cancer remains targeted therapy with TKIs. But once TKIs have been exhausted and the standard historically has been chemotherapy, I think the IMpower 150 regimen is one that at least deserves consideration.
Following the decision to proceed with pembrolizumab monotherapy, Konstantinos Arnotakis, MD, told us that the patient achieves a modest partial response with no significant toxicity. However, after 7 months of therapy, a CT shows growth of several mediastinal and hilar nodes and several new metastases. Listen on to hear Arnotakis, a hematologist and oncologist, associate professor in the Department of Internal Medicine, Division of Hematology and Oncology, the Winthrop P. Rockefeller Cancer Institute at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences, give his take on what the subsequent line of therapy should be.
This patient begins pembrolizumab and achieves a modest partial response with no significant toxicity. After 7 months of therapy, a CAT scan showed growth of several mediastinal and hilar nodes and several new liver metastases. a biopsy of the liver metastasis confirmed non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer. What do you recommend now? The potential options in this poll was carboplatin and pemetrexed, carboplatin, pemetrexed, and pembrolizumab, atezolizumab as monotherapy, and atezolizumab with carboplatin, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab. In this poll, carboplatin and pemetrexed had a 57% preference, 33% chose carboplatin, pemetrexed, and pembrolizumab, 2% chose atezolizumab as monotherapy, and carboplatin, paclitaxel, bevacizumab with atezolizumab was 8%. The carboplatin pemetrexed option was based on the on a standard chemotherapy regimen, which is used for patients with non-small cell lung cancer, non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer. And the combination of chemoimmunotherapy based on the KEYNOTE-189, which was for first-line therapy, but off-label, some people may choose to use it as a second line. The same thing with the data from EMPOWER 150, which is approved as a, and used as a first line, and atezolizumab as a monotherapy after failure of a prior immunotherapy regimen, such as pembrolizumab, which is again not FDA approved, but some people may choose to use since they are slightly different antibodies against PD-1 and PD-L1, respectively. I'm not sure about you, Dr. Liu. What would your preference be in this case?
Well, I think, again, there's one answer that I think is clearly wrong, and it's the use of atezolizumab monotherapy for someone progressing on pembro. And while there is some rationale, and I think some studies ongoing to explore that, right now I would consider that a lateral move, very unlikely to work in a setting where there are other options. And our NCCN guidelines right now do not recommend the use of a PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitor after progression on a different PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitor. So I think there's nothing to really support the use of atezolizumab alone. And I think that the appropriate answer here, if I were taking a board exam, would be chemotherapy. I think carboplatin pemetrexed would be the right board answer. You know, when we move immunotherapy up to the front line, when we change our front line treatment, we have to change all of our downstream regimens as well. And what had been first line therapy before would then become second line. But I do think there's some reason to favor carbo-pem-pembro, the 189 regimen, sort of a different setting. And when we look at this, giving chemotherapy alone versus chemotherapy with pembrolizumab, if we're pursuing a combination in this setting, it would really be based on the potential for synergy between them. Not the additive benefit, because these patients already received pembrolizumab monotherapy. It would really be on the chance that there's potential between them. And we've seen, based on some preclinical data, that when pemetrexed is given to lung cancer cells in culture, we see an upregulation of interferon gamma-related genes, which could facilitate an immune response. And so there is the potential that you could have an increased likelihood of an immune-mediated anti-tumor effect. And so I think that the combination, if pembromono had been well tolerated, and assuming I could get coverage for it, I think the combination is a reasonable approach and probably what I favor in practice. And what's your approach, Dr. Anatakis?
Yes, I'm more going with a more traditional approach of second-line chemotherapy with carboplatin pemetrexed. Although I have to say that it's very tempting when patients have a high PD-L1 expression and they respond to pembrolizumab and later progress to use the combination chemoimmunotherapy. Would your response be different if, for example, the pembrolizumab was not really working from the get-go, from the beginning?
Well, I think if someone had a lot of problems with tolerability, then certainly I'd be more hesitant to fold that in. If toxicity was the issue, then I think chemotherapy alone makes much more sense. And I think until we really know how these drugs work together, it'll be a lot of guessing. Now, fortunately, there is a phase 3 trial that's going to answer some of these very questions that were brought up by both of these polls. You know, the Insignia trial, which is a cooperative group effort, is looking at patients with metastatic non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer, PD-L1 positive, and it's a 3-arm randomization. The first arm starts with pembro monotherapy, and at progression receives chemotherapy, what I think would be the standard approach. second arm receives pembro monotherapy, and at progression, they add chemotherapy. And so they go from pembro mono to pembro plus chemo. And the third arm starts with combination therapy with pembro plus carbo-pem. I think that'll answer a couple very important questions. However, it'll be years before we have those data. And so until we know definitively what is the proper approach, we really have to take it sort of case by case. And I think there are a lot of clinical features that push us in one direction or the other, especially when we're thinking about monotherapy versus chemotherapy. Are there certain patients in your practice, you know, PD-L1 expression aside, where you might be a little more hesitant to give chemotherapy?
Yes. Patients who have autoimmune disease, such as rheumatoid arthritis, who are really not very easily and well controlled with their medications, I'm really hesitant to use immunotherapy. For patients who have rheumatoid arthritis or other autoimmune disease and they are not on treatment, especially if they have a high PD-L1 expression and their options are otherwise limited, the data has shown that these patients can be relatively safely treated with immunotherapy. But for patients who have uncontrolled rheumatoid arthritis or lupus, I will be much more hesitant to use immunotherapy. The same thing applies for patients who have had a bone marrow or a liver transplant. I would be more hesitant to use immunotherapy since the data are not really favoring significantly the safe use of immunotherapy, although the data is really relatively limited at the moment.
Yeah, I'd agree with you there. You know, a lot of our patients, a surprising number, do have a diagnosis of some type of autoimmune disease, but it really depends on the severity, the specific circumstances, and I think we would view someone with active lupus nephritis very differently from someone who had a positive ANA once but never had any symptoms. And so it really comes down to clinical judgment. Certainly there is a risk of flare, there is a risk of other immune-related adverse events, but we have to factor those risks in with the risk of disease and other treatment options. And so I agree with you there. What about the chemotherapy piece for patients who are candidates for immunotherapy alone or immunotherapy plus chemotherapy? Are there certain factors where you just take chemotherapy kind of off the table?
Well, performance status is probably the most critical factor for patients who have a performance status 3 or 4. I would be extremely hesitant to use chemotherapy. Age is always factoring in sometimes in those patients, but the data, as you know, have not really shown significant changes in older patients who have a relatively good performance status. So the performance status for me is still the most critical factor to choose if someone will receive chemotherapy or immunotherapy, even in the first line setting, even with a low PD-L1 expression, based on the fact that immunotherapy is still approved for patients who have a low PD-L1 expression, more than 1%. In patients who have a relatively poor performance status, I may elect to use immunotherapy alone, pembrolizumab, rather than chemotherapy or chemotherapy, immunotherapy together.
Yeah, even though I favor the combination for most of my patients, I admit there are patients I see who I don't feel will be appropriate for combination therapy. And we also have to factor in organ function. You know, to receive pemetrexed safely, we do need a creatinine clearance of about 45. So for patients whose kidney function is impaired, pemetrexed may be less of an option in that setting. Monotherapy or the Empower 150 regimen are really the options that are more appropriate.
Given that immunotherapy has taken on a greater role in the field, do you find yourselves consulting rheumatologists more often in practice?
I do think that the management of immune-related adverse events really does take a multidisciplinary team. And, you know, we have had to engage much more frequently with colleagues in other disciplines, in rheumatology, but also endocrinology for other types of immune adverse events, cardiology, certainly pulmonary medicine. It really has become a more multidisciplinary approach to these types of toxicities.
Yeah, I agree. You know, compared to a few years ago when other specialties were unfamiliar with the side effects of immunotherapy and we had to educate them about the type of toxicity that we encounter with immunotherapy, things now are much better. And we get a lot of great help from other specialties now about confirming and documenting potential autoimmune manifestations of this agent. But it's still, since the number of patients that we treat is still relatively high, we still need to be aware of the management of on endocrine issues, pulmonary issues, GI issues, etc., and sometimes push for a more aggressive workup to document uncommon side effects such as myocarditis or skin manifestations that are related to immunotherapy. So in that sense, we sometimes have to be more aggressive with our specialists to raise the awareness that they can sometimes cause unusual manifestations which are may not be aware.
Okay, I couldn't agree more. You know, with chemotherapy, we're familiar with the side effects, and so when a patient would come in, notice a certain symptom, we may say that's probably not related to your chemotherapy, to your targeted therapy. But for immunotherapy, really all bets are off. And so anything new is potentially related, and in my opinion, you know, even likely related. So I start off thinking that something is related and really trying to prove otherwise. So we really have had to learn a lot more in terms of how to manage these particular drugs than others.
Where does the field stand with regard to immunotherapy, and what is its reach in the overall patient population versus chemotherapy?
So I think there's a tremendous passion for the use of immunotherapy, and certainly that's in part driven by stories in the media, by direct-to-consumer advertising. But I think even beyond that, it's been the outcomes. You know, what we saw this year was long-term survival results from the very first phase one study of pembrolizumab, the KEYNOTE-001 trial. What we saw in that study with a long-term update is that for the treatment-naive patients who received pembrolizumab as first-line therapy, if they had a high PD-L1 score, the five-year survival rate was 30%. It's almost one in three patients alive 5 years later after 2 years of therapy. I think that really changes not just how we manage these patients, but really our perceptions of what's possible when we offer the right therapy to these patients. And the opportunity for meaningful, durable response, I think, is really unrivaled.
Yes, immunotherapy has really revolutionized the field of medical oncology, and definitely there's a lot of excitement. I think there's still a role for chemotherapy in patients with a low PD-L1 expression to activate and make better outcomes. There's a lot of excitement to identify novel also immunotherapy combinations which are currently in clinical trials, which hopefully will give us better results both for the high PD-L1 expression patients but also the low PD-L1 expression.
You know, we've seen that we can accomplish long-term survival, you know, five-year survival for patients with metastatic lung cancer. I think our job now is to build upon that, to make sure that five-year survival really translates to 10-year survival, 20-year survival, potentially cure, which is something we've been hesitant to say. And then to try to offer that type of benefit to more patients, to all patients. I think that's what we'll be spending the next several years or decades doing.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to Onc Live on Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science summits. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have several upcoming State of the Science summits for those interested in attending. If you would like to learn about the latest updates in hematologic malignancies, consider registering for the September 17th State of the Science Summit in Washington, D.C. We will also be hosting a State of the Science Summit on September 25th in Salt Lake City, Utah, which will be focused on advances made in lung cancer. To check out the list of upcoming meetings or to register, go to onclive.com/meetings/SOSS. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive on Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive on Air.